This is the Infotagem podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. Artificial intelligence is becoming more integral to the products we use every day and how governments are planning to deliver public services in the future. Yet concerns have been raised about biases in AI that might promote harmful content or discriminate against people. In response to this, Washington State in the USA has passed a new law requiring third-party access and independent testing of new APIs for facial recognition technologies. This raises the question as to whether this idea should be extended to road test other new technologies as well. I'm Damien Collins, and in this podcast, we'll be discussing these issues with Owen Larter, the Director of Public Policy for the Office of Responsible AI at Microsoft, and co-founder of the Aspen Foundation's Next Gen Network, that has recently produced a report called How AI Can Work for Humanity. We'll be hearing as well from our regular guest, the disinformation analyst, Dr. Charles Creel. I mean, it's fantastic to have you with us on the Infotagem podcast. And I wanted to start off in particular by talking about the Next Gen Network report from the Aspen Institute, which was published last autumn, looking at AI and how AI can work for humanity. We've spoken quite a lot on the podcast over the last few months around the way AI works through social media and recommending content and messages, but it obviously has much wider applications across society. I wonder perhaps if you could tell us a little bit about the work you do with Aspen and the way the network, the Next Gen Network, has been brought together.
Sure. Well, delighted to be here. Thanks very much for having me on. I guess just by way of brief introduction, so I sit in the Office of Responsible AI at Microsoft, which is a team that is a couple of years old. It was developed by Brad Smith, which is the president of Microsoft, and is headed up by Natasha Crampton, who's the company's chief responsible AI officer. And really, the team has a couple of sort of functions. One is internally working with colleagues to roll out governance structures for the way that we use AI at Microsoft, making sure that we take our Microsoft AI principles and help colleagues implement them in the work that they're doing. And then the other part of the team is the bit that I sit in, which is our public policy team, which is really taking that work that we're doing on the responsible AI governance front and taking the work that the company is doing at large, pushing the boundaries of artificial intelligence and using that to make a contribution to the external conversation around regulatory frameworks for AI. And that's sort of a segue into the work around the Next Generation Network. So this is something that Microsoft set up with the Aspen Institute a couple of years ago. And the idea really is to bring together a network of young people from around the world to try and help them develop their understanding of the opportunities around technology. We know there are many, but also the very real challenges that need to be addressed. And in terms of the initial focus, as you mentioned, Damien, the first sort of discussion that we chose to focus on was around this issue of artificial intelligence. For the reasons I mentioned, really, that this feels like it is a, if not the transformative technology of our time. And really, the decisions that we're taking over the next few years are really going to set a course for how this technology is used. So what we did was got the network together. We held workshops in seven different countries, many of which I've mentioned at the top there, and really looked at three issues around how can you use AI to drive positive economic impact, how can you deliver AI ethically, and how can you use it to address major challenges. We published a little report after each of the workshops in those seven countries, and that all fed into a global report, which we published in autumn 2020, as you mentioned. And so maybe just to dig into some of the headline points, and then I'm sure we can drill down a little bit further. The report and the survey that we did alongside it of the group showed, firstly, a huge amount of excitement around artificial intelligence. There was sort of overwhelming belief that these technologies would help people and their countries economically. People thought they would be helpful in their careers. So 88% of the group thought that technology, that AI, would be helpful to them personally in their careers. But the really notable thing from the survey, and particularly the notable thing from the workshop discussions, was the positivity around the societal breakthroughs that AI might be able to drive. So 98%, everyone basically, and this matched up with the tone of the conversation at the workshops, was very excited about the potential for AI in healthcare. I think you've seen that throughout the recent pandemic, the way that artificial intelligence has been used to, you know, map people's immune responses and developing vaccines and treatments. Other societal breakthroughs as well. There's a really interesting conversation we had at the India workshop where people referenced a situation with the Delhi police where they've been able to use facial recognition to correctly identify and reunite 3,000 missing children with their parents over the course of 4 days, which is just a staggering number and a staggering benefit from a technology like facial recognition. But some very real challenges, and I'll quickly run through the three main challenges. The first one was a real concern around the impact of artificial intelligence on human rights. So this was the biggest concern across the group from the survey. Particular concern around how the technology could be used intentionally by non-democratic regimes to undermine human rights, but also a concern in democratic countries that either intentionally or perhaps even unintentionally, there might be an erosion of some democratic freedoms if we're not careful about how the technology is used. Second point was a real concern around the impact of AI on fairness and bias, particularly a concern about any disproportionate impact on minority groups. Real concerns expressed across various different workshop conversations around things like the hiring process, things like algorithms being used by law enforcement, and how they might have a biased and negative impact on a certain section of society. And then final point was around inequality. So there was a conversation around an exacerbation of wealth inequalities and how do you make sure that that doesn't happen? How do you make sure that everyone is able to access and capture the benefits of AI, not just perhaps a small subset of large, well-capitalized companies, but also some really interesting conversations, particularly in India and Mexico, and I think also in the UK, this was mentioned, around growing inequality between organizations and actually a particular concern around a growing inequality between the public sector and government and the private sector. And what happens if governments are not able to utilize these new technologies as effectively as others? Is there a danger that they end up falling behind and are not able to maintain the very important prominent role that they have in society of setting rules, including around the regulations of technologies? There's an interesting, and I'll pause after this, an interesting comment that I think was from the India workshop of, if you imagine going back 100 years and if governments around the world weren't able to fully utilize the new technologies of those times, like electricity and the combustion engine and cars, it would have been a slightly farcical situation that would have played out over the 20th century. So how do we avoid that with the technologies of our era? How do we make sure that governments and the public sector are able to use these technologies and ensure that they are used for the good of society?
Great. Thank you. That's a great overview of the report and the research done by the members of the Next Gen group. I was sort of particularly struck, obviously, given my role as a parliamentarian myself, that there was seemed to be quite an overwhelming view in the survey that governments were most responsible for addressing the challenges of artificial intelligence, and then at the same time a general lack of confidence that governments were well placed to do it. And what do you think? I mean, what do you think the answer to that is? I mean, some people might say, well, governments need to get smarter or, you know, give themselves new regulatory powers. But also, to what extent should the sector itself guard against the potential negative impact of AI?
Yes, very good question. And this was really right at the forefront of a lot of the discussion. There was actually a really positive and reassuring perspective of government as the institution that should be leading the way as, you know, the democratically elected body, representative of the people, in creating these new rules for the use of technology. So actually the report also made three key recommendations, and the top recommendation was that it must be government that leads the way in developing AI rules. But then to your point and the question, the group was very clear that the technology industry in particular has a very real responsibility to support the work of government. I think something that we think is very important at Microsoft is sharing our knowledge of firstly where the technology is going. So obviously we're helping build the technology. We have Microsoft Research, which is leading all kinds of breakthroughs in the field of artificial intelligence. We also have the experience of trying to roll out these governance processes internally that I mentioned at the top. So how do we make sure that we are sharing that information in a way that gives governments the knowledge that it needs to create the right regulations and put the right guardrails around things? The other two points that I'll just mention from that first recommendation around government leading the way were also around the importance of civil society as a voice in the conversation, and actually the general public writ large, and the importance of a sort of diverse range of perspectives across society having a say on how these regulations are being created. So I'd say that in terms of the recommendation from the report and the role that, that technology can play. I'd also go back up to the sort of the point that I mentioned in terms of the findings from the report, which is that it does feel, and the group certainly seem to feel, that it's very important for government to also be using these technologies, A, to remain competitive, but I guess B, to also sort of develop an understanding of how they can be useful themselves.
Absolutely. I think AI will play a big part in the delivery of public services, and probably is to a greater extent playing a bigger role in this sort of year of COVID in helping to do things like allocate resources within the health service in the UK, and I'm sure elsewhere around the world as well. I think it also throws up, though, this debate, some interesting ethical questions, and alongside that, the questions about whether and how the government should regulate in this space, because if AI is being used to create biases within technologies and within systems, then should that be something that external regulators take a look at as well? And on this podcast, we've discussed that quite a lot in the context of, do algorithms amplify disinformation at the expense of factual information, real news? Because in the context of a company, say like Facebook, which has a business model based around engagement that treats often all engagement as positive, whether or not it is the technology part of the problem? It's not just that bad people post bad things, but actually the technology directs people towards them. But we've also seen that complaints about that in other areas as well. There's been recent reports about Uber drivers complaining that they think the Uber algorithm favors white drivers over drivers from minority communities, and a well-cited case in the past of AI Amazon, which favored men over women in the recruitment process in the company because it was learning from previous decisions. I mean, where do you think the line lies here? I mean, to what extent can we trust companies to correct themselves, or do you think we need potentially government regulators with quite extensive reach on some of these issues?
Yeah, I think it's a very important challenge. I know that Microsoft thinks it's a very important challenge, and certainly the Next Gen group did as well. Algorithmic based systems can be incredibly powerful and have a huge amount of opportunity that they can create for society. But as you mentioned, they can, if not trained in the right way and ask the right questions, they can have biases and amplify and exacerbate inequalities in society. I mean, you listed some of the examples there. Facial recognition is something that the company has been taking a really close look at and making some suggestions around what the right guardrails for facial recognition should look like. There have been good studies that have been done across the world. There's one in the US by NIST called Gender Shades, which was very interesting, that showed that the accuracy levels of these facial recognition technologies, or many of them, were much lower when it came to identifying women, when it came to identifying people of color. So you can imagine, if you were then to take that system before it is ready to be used and apply it in a high impact scenario, which could have very real material impact on people's lives, like, for example, use by law enforcement, it could have very, very negative consequences. So I think these are really important discussions to have, and I think it is very important to create those guardrails and those regulatory frameworks to be able to guide the use of these new algorithmic decision-making systems, these new set of technologies that we refer to as AI, in the same way that we've created regulatory frameworks in the spheres of privacy, in the spheres of cybersecurity, as we have created new technologies. So that's something that I think we think is very important. I think a few key points maybe to mention around how we might be able to take the conversation forward on creating these regulatory frameworks. I think there's been a lot of good work done on creating a sort of risk-based approach to how to regulate these systems. So how do you come up with a way of identifying the highest impact, highest risk uses, and making sure that you have guardrails in place for those areas? It may be that many of the systems that we're creating don't actually need a level of regulation if they fall outside of that sort of high risk category. But then I think when you have identified those systems that you want to regulate, there are clearly some important things that you need to be thoughtful about. I think testing these systems, having independent testing and auditing of these systems, including so that you can drive improvements in the accuracy, but also so there is a transparency when people are using them. They understand what the benefits are and what the limitations are of these systems. I think that point around transparency is absolutely key. When you go back to the Microsoft principles that I mentioned at the start, we have six of them. One of the foundational principles is the principle of transparency. That's something that we've tried to do with a lot of the systems that we are building. So our face recognition API, we've put together a transparency note for that, which very clearly lists out to anyone that is going to use it what its capabilities are. When perhaps you shouldn't be using it, the scenarios that you maybe shouldn't be deploying this in, what might impact the effectiveness or the accuracy of this system if you're deploying it in a certain way, in certain lighting, trying to give as much information as possible to the user so that they are informed about what to use this for and maybe what not to use this for. And then I think there's another important point in there around human review. These systems can be really helpful in making suggestions, in identifying trends, maybe even eliminating some bias and some noise that you have in certain systems already that is injected by humans. You know, humans can have their own biases and their own errors. But ultimately, as useful as these systems are, I think we're very clear that they need to remain human-centered and that you must have a human who is able to review and take a final decision, particularly in those high impact areas.
I think that's right. And I think it's one of the things that sometimes gets missed from the debate around AI, that AI is ultimately a tool for humans, created by humans. It's not a sort of autonomous beast it's a system that's been designed to make decisions in a technical environment. But the companies themselves are ultimately responsible for the technology they've created and often how it's moderated. And I think it's when we've looked at other industries, and you mentioned other areas of the tech sector, but most of the major industries have a degree of regulation, but they also have a degree of product testing as well. So you know, new cars will go through rigorous testing. Financial products are analyzed to see whether they're too risky or not. Gambling products are regulated in the same way on a risk-based assessment. I mean, do you think for the tech sector we should have a norm where new products in particular go through a sort of sandbox type trials where a company can test them out and then produce a report showing how they work, how they're moderated, to make sure that the technology doesn't, there are unintended consequences of a new technology or a new product being launched?
Yeah, I think that's really an important part of the debate. And actually, if you look at the law that passed in Washington State at the start of last year, which was a law around facial recognition technology, that independent testing was a part of the law. And I think it is an important part, particularly when you're using these systems, again, in those high impact areas. So I think independent third party testing, I think, is very important. And again, just coming back to this point that I mentioned before around companies themselves, of course, doing rigorous testing and being transparent about that testing and being transparent about all of the great things that the technologies can do, but also being very transparent around the limitations of certain technologies and where the technologies shouldn't be applied. I mean, it may well be that At some point down the line, as technology continues to develop, you can use these technologies in a broader and broader fashion. But that if you were to deploy them currently, it would be premature and could lead to material harm. So we actually take decisions on the basis of that testing and a review process that we've set up internally. We have a sensitive use case review, quite a structured process whereby if we think there is potential premature use or potential harm that might come from the use of a system in a particular scenario, we will put it through a process and take a decision. And so we have taken decisions before not to sell certain technologies in certain scenarios. So for example, last year we decided not to work with a California police department on facial recognition technology, because based on our own testing and understanding of how they were looking to deploy it, that was a premature use and wouldn't be helpful to them and could potentially lead to negative impacts across society. So yes, I think independent testing and transparency from companies themselves around what the technology can do and what the technology can't and shouldn't do is a really, really important part of the puzzle.
That's it. Now you're joining us from Washington State on the West Coast of America. I mean, for the benefit of our viewers around the world, this system of independent testing that Washington State requires, is it stipulated who should do it, and also who, you know, how the results of the tests are shared?
Yeah, I think it will change on country to country what the system should look like, but obviously you need an independent authority that has credibility locally that can do that kind of testing. So we looked in our conversations across the US at organizations like NIST, so the local standards authority. You can imagine in other countries having an organization like that, or perhaps a regulator in a particular sector might be the kind of thing that countries should be looking at.
But in Washington State, is there a sort of individual body, or can you work with universities, or just a credible organization that's external to the company?
Yeah, so in Washington State, the law will come into force in summer this year. So I think a lot of the implementation is still being worked through.
Okay, but has the state sort of given a clear view yet, or is this still something it's resolving?
I think that's something that's still being worked through.
Okay, well, so I think it's a sort of interesting, very interesting innovation. And one of the things I think we like to do on the podcast is look at what's going on around the world and see whether good ideas people have had in one part of the world could be applied elsewhere as well. So I certainly just think it's something we'll want to keep an eye on. Charles Creel is with us, as usual, on the podcast. But before I bring Charles in, there was just one other point from the report I wanted to ask you about, because, again, it's something we've talked about here before, is the idea of having some sort of international convention or some basic common rules that could be applied around the world, and which in some ways we might expect international companies to adhere to wherever they do business. And I wondered whether that in the report of the Aspen Institute, whether that was something that you'd given some consideration to as to how that might work. In the past, we've talked here about having a kind of like Bretton Woods convention, but for tech, in the same way after the Second World War, that agreement was made for financial services. And it'd be interesting to know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, so this was something, it was actually the second recommendation from the report, was that some kind of international convention would be helpful in terms of coming up with the regulatory framework for artificial intelligence. We think the international conversation is really, really important. We being Microsoft, we've actually contributed to quite a lot of the international conversation and tried to support where possible sort of multi-stakeholder conversation around regulation of technology in general in the international arena in a rules-based way. So we actually set up a UN affairs office at the start of last year based in New York. So this is almost a sort of permanent representation to the United Nations from Microsoft to try and support the UN in its sustainable development goals, including where those goals overlap with technology issues around regulation of issues like cybersecurity. I think there's a lot that we can learn from the cybersecurity world. So we've been very supportive of things like the Tech Accord, which was launched, I believe, last year, the Paris Call for Trust in cyberspace. I think there's a lot that we can roll over into this international conversation around AI as well. And I think there's good momentum and a good start that has been made on that front. I mean, people might be familiar with the work that the OECD has been doing. They've set out some AI principles, which were agreed to by the OECD members. They've set up their AI policy observatory to help with implementation of those principles. I think the key will be joining some of these conversations together. I think the stuff that is positive around the OECD is the way in which they're working with organizations like the G20 and the UN, so that you have a global perspective and global inputs into these conversations. I think that's a key point that has certainly come out from the Next Generation Network conversations is, and really one of our guiding mantras is trying to have a sort of broad and diverse set of inputs into these conversations. There was an interesting paper that was created recently by the Future Society looking at these various initiatives around AI principles at a regional and international level. And it observed, perhaps maybe not that surprisingly, that the majority of the running has been coming out of the EU and the US. And then actually, if you look at the number of these initiatives in places like LATAM, I think it was around 7%, Africa, a smaller number still. So I think you do need a truly global conversation if you're going to have a global set of standards and regulations that is going to allow everyone to use this technology for the good.
I think that's right. And I think whilst we may not have agreement on everything and trying to get, say, the EU, the US and China in the same place, you know, is probably impossible. But I think some basic rules standards we should expect companies to work to anywhere when they do business around the world, almost regardless of what the local laws are. In much the same way in the financial sector, we have through the Bribery Act in the UK and the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in America, there are some sort of like standards that applied around the world that many countries share in principle, wherever their citizens or their businesses work, and that may avoid some of the problems we've seen, particularly countries of the world where standards may be lower, but certainly in the context of social media disinformation and hate speech, we've seen things take place in some of those countries, like Myanmar in particular, that are rightly regarded as atrocious. And you know, I think we should expect some common standards in the way companies work, even in harder to reach parts of the world.
I wanted to jump in and answer your question on the testing front, because I didn't give you a very solid answer on that before, and I've actually just dug back through the legislation. And so basically the legislation stipulates that a technology provider must make available an API or other technical capability to enable legitimate, independent and reasonable tests for accuracy and unfair performance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it has to be baked into the technology that it can be tested. And I guess the next stage then is to work out what the right independent authorities to be testing it are. Although I presume with the API, it would mean a number of people might be able to test the effectiveness and accuracy of the system.
Okay, yeah, that's I think that's a really, really interesting initiative. And we'll look forward to looking at that further when it goes live in the summer. But Charles, thanks so much for being with us again. And what's caught your attention over the last few days?
Hi, Damien. Well, good to be here again. As are so many people, I am definitely watching the second impeachment of Donald Trump. But also, in the past few days, in the midst of all this flurry, there have been a couple of other events that are worth looking at. And one of them is that the CEO of one of the fastest growing social media networks was sacked, and it's been pretty much lost. John Matz, who's the CEO of Parler, or was the CEO, was dismissed by the company's board of directors, with Rebecca Mercer chairing the action. Now, Parler is the relatively new social media network that, until really recently, it was popular with political conservatives. It was founded by Rebecca Mercer, the far-right political operative who works closely with her billionaire father, Robert Mercer. Now, between the two of them, they've either supported or founded Breitbart, Cambridge Analytica, and its follow-up, Emerdata, not to mention dozens of far-right candidates and causes. Cambridge Analytica whistleblower Chris Wiley has tweeted about how former CEO Alexander Nix used to dream about the company and conservative movement having its own social media platform. Well, Parler was that platform. But after the January 6th insurrection in the U.S. Capitol, Google, Apple, and most critically, Amazon shut down Parler's operations, both in the app stores and on Amazon Web Services, which hosted the Parler backend. Parler CEO Mats moved their domain hosting to a Russian company, but Parler hasn't reappeared as no one is willing to host their operation. And even that Russian company uses Amazon Web Services, so that option is now a dead end. Now, does any of this have anything to do with Mats' sacking? Probably. If you go over Parler's operations, there seem to have been a number of strange decisions made that led to their rapid demise. So, for example, Mats said after Amazon shut down their hosting that Parler would have to rewrite their code from scratch. And what that means to me is that Parler was taking advantage of Amazon-specific shortcuts in their systems architecture, which made them wildly dependent on AWS services. Now, Mats disagrees with this general reasoning about his sacking based on performance. He told USA Today that he was fired without severance and stripped of his equity, too. That it came about after he spoke out about how his vision from Parler differed from that of Mercer and her colleagues. So just what is this vision thing? Well, it's hard to know. Parler played a major role in the organization of January 6th, and a USA Today text analysis, which was published last week, showed that calls for civil war intensified on Parler as Trump urged his followers to march on the Capitol. And Matt says disagreements over how to regulate that kind of speech on Parler is what pitted him against Mercer. He says he urged Parler to crack down on neo-Nazis and other domestic terrorists that were inciting violence, but that Mercer was unresponsive. Now, users are looking for replacements. There's the alternative social network, Gab, and January 6th organizer Ali Alexander has now resorted to email shots from hiding as he's trying to raise money for his legal defense. But in the meantime, Parler is gone and Mats is out of a job.
It's an extraordinary story. And I think whilst there's been so much focus on Twitter and Facebook deplatforming Donald Trump, that in some ways the decision of by Amazon to turn off Parler was in some ways even more extraordinary.
It really is. I mean, you know, Amazon probably runs 2/3, 3/4 of the internet. And if AWS went out, so would the internet. It's an extraordinary amount of power that they have. So them shutting them down, shutting Parler down, it's indicative of many different things. I mean, first of all, it's indicative that big data companies and big social media do in fact make editorial decisions. And that opens up all kinds of doors for the way that regulation works in that space.
Absolutely. And I think, and it's also in such a sort of absolute decision. I mean, it's not just regulating content on a platform, but actually saying that you've so little confidence in the entire systems of that organization that its mere existence is potentially harmful.
For sure. What's uncomfortable is that between Amazon, Apple, Google, et cetera, what you have is the power to make or break companies, make or break speech, et cetera. And this is huge testimony to the kind of monopolies that they have. Another example might be, say, Google basically holding Australia to ransom over issues about making payments to newspapers when they use their content.
Yeah, although it seems that Google are softening their position on that a little bit now, doesn't it? It seems like they're prepared to do a deal, probably not quite what the Australians at the level they want, but nevertheless, it seems that there's been a bit of movement on that.
Yeah, absolutely. It just feels as though governments should not be negotiating with corporations over the operation of services for citizens.
Yeah. Now, Owen, before we wrap up, I don't necessarily expect a sort of a Microsoft corporate position on this, but I'd be interested in your personal view. Obviously, Microsoft, you know, in the past went through antitrust investigations in Europe and the US, which were resolved to the satisfaction of the authorities. Do you think in the next few years we're going to see more of these actions and investigations into companies like Google and Amazon and Facebook, as Charles said, that they're looked at as a series of monopolies rather than companies that are always in direct competition?
It's a good question, and it certainly seems like there is some momentum around that conversation, doesn't there? And I think that's certainly something that we've learned from in our own experience as a company that has, you know, has been around for almost sort of 50 years now, is sort of the importance of thinking about your role as a company and how you can empower people in countries to sort of take advantage of your technology in a way that also benefits them. So yeah, I would say it's clearly a conversation with some momentum, and I think we'll presumably be seeing a lot more over the years ahead.
Yeah, I think going back to the, I mean, there are lots of issues that the regulators and the courts in America are starting to look at now. But I think going back to the point we were talking to Charles about the decision of Amazon to sort of delist Parler, regardless of people might think of Parler, and there'll be many people who listen to this podcast, you know, probably not shedding many tears that it's gone. But it does beg an interesting question about whether one company should have the power to make that decision alone, and whether there should be some guidance or framework that it should work through before making it, or even should only do so in response to a request from some authority.
Yeah, I think it's these are really tricky issues and really important conversations, and it almost sort of comes back up to the broader point that the Next Generation Network is trying to look at, which is what is the right sort of set of frameworks that we can decide on in the next few years that will stand the test of time over the coming decades and will allow us to use technology in society in a way that we are happy with and that adheres to, you know, the long-standing values that we have as democratic societies. So these are really, really tricky conversations, but it feels like they're coming to a point where progress is going to be made on them.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast and sharing your thoughts on these issues as well.
Fantastic to be here. Thank you for having me on.
You've been listening to the Infotagem podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, featuring Owen Larter and Charles Creel. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagem, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagem.com, or using hashtag IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can also support this show by becoming a Patreon at patreon.com/InfotagemPodcast. Infotagem is a not-for-profit organisation, and all proceeds will go to the making of this show. Thank you, until next time.